Namaste, Mandela here. I'm very excited to collaborate with Explorer Maps, a small family business based in Missoula, Montana. Visit exploremaps.com to learn about how we are working together to connect people and place through art and storytelling.
Welcome to The Trail Less Traveled, an adventure radio series and podcast dedicated to collecting stories and sounds from around the world in order to take you back to mankind's earliest form of entertainment, storytelling. This episode was recorded on location in collaboration with Explorer Maps. Missoula, Montana is a mecca for outdoor enthusiasts, and each week we will bring you tales of adventure from both near and far, as well as information and inspiration and a few tunes to set the mood. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn about our international outreach projects at traillesstraveled.net. And now, here's your host, international expedition guide, conservationist, and yogi, Mandela.
We're on location in Baja California Sur in Mexico on the Sea of Cortez. We're about an 8-mile paddle north from a base camp here on the Sea of Cortez, sitting on rocks overlooking low tide. And I'm sitting here with Gary Steele, a good friend of mine, an adventure partner, and we are here on location to talk to Gary about sailing. But first, Gary, I'd love for you to give a little teeny-weeny bit of your background for those who didn't catch the show last week, your experience in your adventures, and then pick it up with the sailing that you did in and around the Caribbean with the 23 Peaks Expedition.
I moved to Montana in 76. I was 23 years old. Started a whole new life for myself. Moved to the mountains, rode horses, and adventured, and Montana was a good place for me. It had all the things that Phoenix didn't: trees, lakes, rivers, mountains, and cool weather. But as much as I like Montana, I still have to adventure off in different places. Well, this was actually the first time where I ever really left the country, and this Montana boy experienced third world countries for the first time. But the 23 Peaks Expedition, it was put together by a friend of mine, Phil Buck, and also Steve Smith, who lives in Montana, has been my friend for many years. Steve got me invited on the trip. Phil Buck, he wanted to be the first person to have a team climb the highest peak in North, South, and Central America. And Phil had done other feats of accomplishment somewhere along these lines in the past. He'd already climbed the peaks of South America, and he was working his way north, and he figured the best way to get to the peaks of Central America was be to charter a small sailboat. So a friend of his, Tim, had a 35-foot wooden schooner, so they made a deal that Tim was going to provide the boat and the transportation, and he would take the climbing team down to Central America, where the climbing team would depart, and the sailing team would hold the boat until the climbing team got back. So that was the overall plan of the mission. I was invited to be part of the sailing team. So I flew into Florida. From there, I met up with the crew and the 35-foot wooden schooner, the Hippo. So there was the captain of the boat, Tim, my buddy Steve Smith, who I've known for many years, Phil Buck, the leader of the expedition, and Phil's wife, Ellie, who is from Chile, and Ellie's son, Mark, who was less than a year old. All of us was going to depart on the 35-foot Hippo, which isn't a very big boat. It was crowded conditions, but it was an adventure. We left Florida, crossed over to the Bahamas. We got in the Bahamas at night. The wind was up, the waves were up. Our maps were poor. We had no GPS. We had only a compass, but we didn't know where we was because it was dark. We continued on sailing through the Bahamas. It was very interesting. The Bahaman Keys, real sandy keys with palm trees and brush around, and iguanas. The snorkeling was wonderful. From the Bahamas, we crossed to Jamaica. We pulled into the little town of Port Antonio. We went into the little working man's dock. we was trying to avoid the yachty's hangouts, the big ports that the yachty's hang out. So we went into the working man's port. We were the only gringo boat in there. They treated us real nice. They were a little surprised we showed up there. It was quite interesting, Jamaica. The whole scene kind of revolves around reggae, Rasta, and ganja. As we were leaving, sailing out of Jamaica, it just happened to be Bob Marley's birthday. We had the radio on in the boat. I realized when we was leaving there that I had a whole different attitude about a lot of things. I had no interest in reggae music whatsoever before I went to Jamaica, but I seen something that the people there were really proud of, their music. And a lot of them don't have a whole lot of things to be proud of, but they were proud of their music. And we sailed away from there with a whole different attitude as when I came there. So we embarked on our 600-mile crossing. It took, I think, 3 or 4 days. We fished along the way, just drug a fishing lure behind us. I was catching some really nice Dorado, which we would either cook up for dinner or make jerky out of. When we were making that big crossing, sometimes Ellie would be exhausted from taking care of the little baby, Mark, and she'd want to catch a little nap or something, so one of us other sailors would volunteer to take care of Mark. When it was my turn, what I find I would do, we were all up on deck, it was too crowded and hot below deck, so I just tied a little parachute cord to Mark's suspenders, and when he would crawl across the deck, when he'd get too close to the side of the boat, I would just pull him gently in with the nylon cord, and he'd slide across the deck, and his eyes would get big. We dropped the climbing team off in Honduras. The baby Mark and Ellie departed with the climbing team, although they weren't going to climb. Steve and Phil were going to climb the highest peaks in Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, and then they were going to meet us back in Guatemala. So they all departed. Then it was just Tim and I on the sailboat. Immediately, I was promoted to first mate. From there, we proceeded to the Bay Islands off the coast of Honduras. We pulled into a little island of Utila. It was a mecca for snorkeling and diving, all sorts of diving schools there. The little town on the island of Utila was very unique. There was no cars in town. All the streets were sand. The buildings, hotels, and restaurants of the old style clapboard. Very interesting. We could hear about any language of the world walking on those streets. We snorkeled and explored Utila for a few days. And then one evening, we were anchored in a beautiful little bay. And the captain, Tim, says, "I think we ought to pull out of here. I don't like the weather." I go, "Well, aye aye, Captain. That's what you say." So we pulled out of there. The sun was starting to go down. And we had very poor maps. I'm not even sure we had any maps. We had no GPS. So we were sailing by dead reckoning, and we sailed directly south until Captain Tim thought we were clear of all the coral reefs. We didn't really have any good maps with us, so it was kind of a by guess and by golly situation. He thought we were clear. We turned the boat directly to the west and had a good tailwind, and we were clipping along really good. Tim went up to the front of the boat to watch, and I was on the tiller. We had about a 3-foot following sea and a pretty stiff little breeze. We were clipping right along, and all of a sudden the light was getting dimmer, but Tim thought he seen breaking waves in front of us. And as we got a little bit closer, there was for sure breaking waves, which means waves crashing on coral reefs, to the front, left, and right of us. We had sailed into a cul-de-sac of coral reefs, and if the boat was to crash on these coral reefs, it would be broken up to splinters, and Tim and I would have been ground up into fish bait. Tim hollered back to me as soon as he recognized the situation. He said, "Hard port!" and I cranked the tiller all the way over to the port. He came running down, dropped the sails as he went down below, and he turned the diesel engine on as I had, and the boat was slowly making that turn. We wasn't sure there was enough room to make the turn, but that was our only alternative. And the diesel engine cranked in, and we was able to make that turn and just barely pull out. We were, you know, maybe 5 yards off the crashing waves of the coral reef when we finally got turned around and pointed back in an easterly direction. And just when it looked like we was probably going to survive this ordeal, the full moon came up over the water right in front of us to welcome us back to the world of the living. So we got out of that mess. We sailed all night doing 2-hour shifts. That gets pretty old about 3 or 4 in the morning. I was on one of my later shifts. I noticed a light off the starboard, off to the right, off into the sea. It was the only light out there. It was a big open sea. But it never changed. It just stayed in the same place. Tim came on watch. Same thing. He watched the light. Never changed. I came back on watch somewhere around 5 o'clock, something like that. It was really hard to stay awake at this point. That light, it was still in the same place, right off to the starboard. Hadn't changed, except started looking maybe just a little bit different. Now, I didn't realize this. I didn't have enough sailing knowledge, but there's a thing called constant bearing decreasing range. Constant bearing decreasing range. And that means when a light is off to one side and it doesn't change, that means you're on a collision course. And I had no idea about this. Our boat did not have a light on it at all. We were sailing in total darkness. This other boat just had one light on it. That's all we could tell. It was starting to get daylight just a little bit, and it was really hard for me to stay awake. I'd been awake, hadn't slept really much all night. So I'd doze off a little bit and look up, oh, that light's still there, but it looks a little different. I called Tim up on deck. I go, Tim, come look at this. And he came up all groggy-eyed and looked. Oh, it's nothing. He went back to sleep. About another 10, 15 minutes later, there was just something about that light that was ominous to me, and it seemed to be moving. When it was really dark, you couldn't see the horizon between where the sea and the sky meet. But as it was starting to get just a little bit lighter, that light was above the horizon. And I go, oh, something's wrong. Something's seriously wrong here. But I didn't know what to do about it. I had, I'd never been in this situation before. But after a few more minutes, there was just getting to be enough light that I could see the whole horizon was covered by a huge ship. The bow of a ship was coming right on us. And at this point, I hollered down, I screamed down at Tim. I go, Tim, get up here. And he came running up there, and he took one look, and he knew exactly what was going on. We were about to get run over by a huge freighter. He screamed at me again, hard port. And I cranked the tiller over. Tim, he didn't even have time to put the sails down. He just ran down below, started the engine, and we slowly started our turn. And we had just turned to about 90 degrees from what our original course was when the huge mountain of steel came sweeping by us about 5 yards away. And it must have been 3 to 5 stories high and just ominous, barnacle-encrusted mountain of steel. And the first bow wake, even though the actual boat was missing us, the huge bow wake from this boat laid the little hippo all the way over on its side. And I thought we were just going to flounder right there. But the hippo, it was well designed, and she came back up again, and then it was hit by the second and third bow wakes, which diminished in size from the first one. But again, we had just barely survived, and as the big freighter that had Chiquita written on the side sailed off to the south, and we were now pointed to the east again, the sun came up over the water, just as the moon had earlier that evening, welcoming us back to the world of the living, which we very nearly left. Mandela and I are sitting in our kayaks about a mile offshore in the Sea of Cortez. The sun just came up. We paddled out here early to watch the sunrise over the water. Large fish splashed behind us while we were getting ready to make this recording. There's about six or seven islands behind us. In front of us is the rugged skyline with scattered peaks and cordon cactus. The seabirds are flying overhead, and we are doing this live on location for the trail, less traveled. And here is my friend, Mandela.
Awesome. Like Gary said, we're on location on the Sea of Cortez in our sea kayaks, and we're going to speak to Gary now about some of his adventures via dual sport motorcycle, other types of motorcycles, but mainly the dual sport. Gary rides a KLR 650 dual sport motorcycle.
One of the eventful stories that I would like to relay here, you can probably hear our kayaks bumping in the background. This happened about 4 or 5 years ago. I went down to Bisbee, Arizona, and I met up with a couple of friends that were also riding KLRs. And our goal was to go down into the Sierra Madres and look for this old Apache camp where the Apaches used to hide out from the U.S. Cavalry in a little mountain village way in the Sierra Madres. To get there, it was some major rugged roads. We decided to cross the border at Agua Prieta. We had exchanged money in the United States. When we exchanged money and we was kind of in a hurry, I put all my money in one pocket, which is a mistake. But I'd never had any trouble in Mexico before. I've traveled thousands of miles through Mexico and Central America on my motorcycle, and I had never had any problem at all. So I was a little bit lackadaisical. Well, we were doing our paperwork to get across the borders with our motorcycles. There was a guy kind of hanging around, a Mexican guy. He had shifty eyes. I didn't care for him at all, but he was the only guy standing around, and I needed to get directions to get out of town. It's always easy to get into town from back roads, but it is never easy to find the back roads out of town. So I took the opportunity and asked the guy with the shifty eyes how to get out of town, and he knew exactly how, and he gave us really good directions, and then we continued on with our procedure, and he was gone. We headed out of town. We made one little wrong turn, delayed us a little bit, but the directions he gave us was really good. So we were about a couple of 2 or 3 miles out of town. It was rural, desert, hilly, dirt road. We were spread out about 200 or 300 yards between the three of us so we wouldn't be eating each other's dust. Ed was in the lead, I was second, and my buddy Bill was in the back. When I topped this rise, I thought I seen something funny going on in the road in front of me. And when I topped the next rise, there was Ed's bike laying in the road with a guy standing over him pointing a gun at him. Another man with a t-shirt mask was standing very near the situation. I proceeded on into the situation, and I could have rode right past. Well, I did ride right past, but I couldn't leave my buddy Ed there alone with a gun pointed in his face. So I stopped my bike about 40 yards past where Ed was. My little mind was running as fast as I could, trying to figure out, okay, what do I do next? So I just walked back there. When I got to the scene, the bandit pointed the gun in my face and said, "Dinero, motherfucker." And I go, oh. And I knew at that point I'd screwed up because all my money was in one pocket and I had, I don't know, $800 or $1,000, which I usually always split my money up just for a situation like this so I can give the bandit $30 or $40 and then he'll be happy and I'll be happy, but I had not done that. And I had traveled thousands of miles in Mexico and never had a problem before, but this time I did. When he demanded my money, I just said no. And Ed, at this point, who was fluent in Spanish, he kind of took over because he knew I was carrying a lot of money and he was carrying very little money. And Ed told the bandit, and he goes, I got all the money. Help me set the bike up and I'll give you the money. So the bandit said, no, just get the money now. All in Spanish. Ed said no. Ed insisted that, well, we got to set the bike up, which was stalling for time. Well, we were doing this, the other bandit with the t-shirt on, which I had recognized a little bit earlier by the shifty eyes. And that's why he had the t-shirt on. The other bandit with the gun was not trying to conceal his face. And there was another bandit, an accomplice, off over the hill watching the road for dust to see if anybody might be driving on the road to interfere with the robbery taking place. The bandit with the shifty eyes, he was working Bill over for money. The big bandit with the gun was waiting for Ed to get his bike up so we could give him some money. And the lookout on the hill was starting to holler. I couldn't tell what he was saying, but I could tell he was anxious to get this job over with and done, so I knew time was on our side. Finally, we got Ed's bike up, and Ed got his fanny pack out and handed the guy his billfold, which the guy took all the cash out of it, which was only $40. Took Ed's cell phone, and by this time, the lookout was starting to holler quite a bit. So that was good enough for the bandits. They each got about $40 from Ed, about $40 from Bill, and then they took off running across the desert. And we were kind of left standing there, goes, wow, we just got robbed. It felt kind of intrusive and invasive because none of us had ever been robbed at gunpoint before. I'm not sure the gun would have fired. I have heard stories before of some of the Mexican bandits being so broke that they don't have money for ammunition. When I did walk up to the gun, I looked, it was a 9-shot .22 revolver. I looked into the ends of the cylinders. I could not see the ends of any of the bullets in the ends of the cylinder. And I also checked the condition of the gun out, and it was not in very good condition, but I was not willing to test the situation. But anyway, we got out of it as good as we possibly could, a robbery. They didn't get any money from me. And Ed and Bill didn't lose that much. So we saddled up and continued riding, but we were a little shook up. It was hard to be very centered after that. We rode, another 2 hours or so. And by then it was afternoon and we were looking for a place to camp. We found this little off-road that was lined with big 8-foot-tall choyas on each side of the road. We went down that road. I was taking the lead at this point, looking for a place to camp. And I wasn't as focused as I should be. I was moving very slowly, but my front wheel caught some sand, and down I went. The cargo boxes on the back of my bike caught the heel of my boot and hyperextended my foot out. As I was going down, I could feel the weight of the bike coming onto my foot. And then I heard something snap, and I knew right away from my experiences being an EMT on Mission Ambulance that this is not a good situation. Together, Ed and Bill lifted my bike off of my leg, which I rolled over into the sand and told them that I was definitely hurt. I didn't know how bad yet. I thought something was broken. They were asking me what to do. Since I was the EMT, they always refer to the EMT for, "What do we do now, Gary?" I don't know. So I laid there for a little bit, evaluating the situation, palpating my ankle. They helped me stand up. There was no way I could put any weight on the ankle whatsoever. And it was starting to get dark. I was laying in the middle of the road, which wasn't much of a road at this point. Okay, we got to find the closest place to camp right away. I managed to get back on my bike, start it up, hold my ankle out to the side and ride that 50 yards into camp because I certainly couldn't have walked. Where my friends helped me off my bike and set me down in my crazy crick chair. So when camp was set up, we sat down and we drank our beers. What else was there to do at this point? We laughed about the situation, and in a bad situation like this, it is really good to have good, solid adventure companions. I felt very good with my companions at this point, and I've always felt good with them. I have done some grand adventures with both of my friends. We sat there and drank beer, talked about the whole situation, what we were going to do next. The next morning, I splinted my leg up. I had a couple of shin and knee guards for riding through rough country to protect my shins and knees from rocks, and I took and modified those and made a splint for my leg, taped it up as tight as I could, laced my boot up tight, and was going to have to ride back into Agua Prieta and back into Bisbee. It was about a 3-hour ride. It was my right foot So I couldn't use my rear brake on the motorcycle, but I could just kind of set my foot on the foot peg, but I couldn't put any weight on it. And we rode back into Agua Prieta and Bisbee. It all went pretty uneventful. We did run into some police along the way. They asked what had happened and asked if we wanted an ambulance, and we said, no, we're doing okay. We went back to Ed's house in Bisbee, and I recuperated for about 10 days. Right after Christmas, or maybe Christmas Day, we headed south to Copper Canyon, which is in the northern Sierra Madres of northern Chiricahua, Mexico. It took us several days to ride down there. Bill kept getting flat tires for some reason. He'd get about 2 flat tires a day on his rear tire. We drove through rain and snow and some really gnarly conditions. But we finally got to Creel, which is kind of at the top of the Copper Canyon area. Stayed for a couple days to check the area out. The weather wasn't very good because Creel is about at 7,000 feet. So we headed down into the canyon to the town of Batopilas. And it's on the Batopilas River. And it is a legendary motorcycle adventure road to get down into the canyon. As we're driving down this little gnarly switchback dirt road, there's places you can look down the canyon and see 6 or 7 switchbacks below us, which we would soon be negotiating. And then a little 2-lane rickety wooden bridge over a raging whitewater river and more of the same. We got into Batopilas, a beautiful little town, a huge plaza right in front of our hotel with great big fig trees, I believe they were. The indigenous people, the Tarahumara Indians, frequent this town, and it is one of the only areas in the Copper Canyon area where the Tarahumara people still dress in their traditional clothes. The women all wear their hand-woven clothes. The men wear their little white skirt and sandals that lace up their legs. They are known for running vast distances through the canyon. They are very tough, durable people. This is also an area where a lot of drugs are grown, both cocaine and marijuana. So it is an area of the canyon that you don't want to wander around aimlessly in places that you should not really be. We had the freedom of mobility, and it's always easy to make friends when you're on a motorcycle, I have found out. I noticed the day that we were leaving, I was starting to get sick. And I had been very sick before in Batopilas. I had stayed in the same hotel before, and it about killed me. At that time, I was traveling by myself with bus, and I got sick down in the same hotel. I tried to wait it out. I just kept getting sicker and sicker. Finally, I took the bus back to the United States. By the time I got there, which it was a harrowing journey when I was so sick. By the time I got back to the United States that time, I had lost over 10 pounds, and it took me almost a month to recover from the bout. And that started flashing back into my mind. We was riding up the switchback road to get out of Batopilas. Things just weren't feeling right with me. I kept getting sicker. That night, it hit me big time. I was sweating and puking and shivering, and by morning I was a complete basket case. I had quite a bad case of pneumonia. Finally, after 10 days of bad weather, we was debating on how we were going to get out of Creel at this point. Our destination was Baja. We was going to take the ferry across from Topolobampo. So what we decided to do, we put our motorcycles on a train, on a freight train, which was quite an ordeal, getting the bikes raised up to the level of the car and then getting them in the car that was packed full of bags of grain and corn and all sorts of cargo. We lashed them down the best we could. We couldn't ride with them. We had to take the passenger train the next day. It's a legendary train through the Sierras down to Las Mochis that goes over trestles that you're looking down, it seems like 1,000 feet into rivers and switchbacks and going through these little villages of the Tarahumara. That's one of the most scenic railroads in the world. But we got to Las Mochis late at night, found a hotel. The next morning, we went to the train station, and amazingly, our bikes were in perfect condition, just sitting there waiting for us. we proceeded to the ferry station, crossed the Sea of Cortez in an all-night-long ferry boat ride. In the morning, we had breakfast in La Paz. That's where Bill and I was going to part company. Bill was going in one direction. I was going to another direction. I was heading back to my base camp, which is where we're at right now, or just offshore of my base camp. I proceeded to get to camp. It took a full day of riding to get here, and I was still not well at all, but I was home in Baja. I just spread my pad out on the sandy beach, laying in the sun, and this is where I stayed and finished my recovery from the pneumonia. I was home, the sun was shining on me, I was in Baja, and life was good. So that's kind of the end of that little misadventure tale, where I was robbed, hurt, and sick all on the same trip. I'm glad they don't all go like that, by golly.
We're floating in our sea kayaks right offshore at Gary's base camp, which he's been coming to for the past 25 years in Baja California Sur. Gary, let's play a song. Let's play a song that reminds you of all these misadventures that you encountered on this dual sport motorcycle trip throughout Mexico and the time that you were on your motorcycle that you enjoyed it, but mostly coming back after these misadventures to your base camp, which we're at right now in Baja California Sur on the Sea of Cortez, a place you've been coming to for 25 years. And at the time that this happened, you had been coming there for 17 years at least, laying on the warm sand and just knowing that you're home.
It was so good to be home, just to lay on the sand and relax. And the song that comes to mind, a friend of mine here, Don Carlin, wrote it. It's to an old cowboy tune, The Night Rider's Lament. But Don wrote it, and he calls it the Baja Lament. And I would like to ask my friend Steve Smith, who's sitting here next to me, if he would play that for us.
We all try to explain why we come here to our friends in the cold northern lands. We tell stories for hours in their ivory towers. It's just something they can't understand. They ask us, why do you go down to Baja? What's there to do way down there? There's nothing around, and you're so far from town. Tell me what's there to find way down there. But they've never seen the sunrise with the Sierra Gigante behind. I've floated in moonlight on a tranquil sea. No, we're surely not out of our minds. We show them all of the pictures and tell them it's better by far. They say it's all true, it's a beautiful view, but we have to get out of our car. They ask us, why do you go down to Baja? So far from the comforts of home. You're living outside from the wind you can't hide. And there's no service for our cellular phone. Ah, but they've never seen the dolphin smile or a ray flying free as can be. They've never been swimming in a rainbow of life or eating fish fresh from the sea. Now our friends are polite, and they say it sounds nice. We tell them, we'll show them the way. They hear our advice, and then they say they'll think twice, 'cause they've got a big mortgage to pay. They ask us, why do you go down to Baja? 50 miles or more to a store. You wash your dishes in the sea, in the bushes you pee. And a shower's a gallon, no more. But they've never hiked up an arroyo, seen the Great Canyon behind, lingered there in the cool silent shade. No, they just don't know how to unwind. These days when those folks, they ask me, I just smile and open a beer. Baja's a dangerous zone, you're much safer at home, 'cause we don't need a crowd way down here. They still ask us, why do you go down to Baja on roads that are narrow as hell? Washboards and dust, water you cannot trust. Well, we honestly don't think you're well. But they've never seen the pelicans dive, or the feet of a booby so blue. They've never heard the osprey's sweet cry. Tell me there's nothing to do. No, don't tell me there's nothing to do.
That was Baja's Lament, inspired by the classic cowboy song Night Rider's Lament. Baja Lament was written by Don Carlin in Baja California Sur on the shores of the Sea of Cortez, performed for the Trail Less Traveled live in Baja by a friend of Don and Gary, Steve Smith, or as he goes by in Baja, Guitar Steve. Explorer Maps and the Trail Less Traveled bring cartography to life through storytelling, conservation, culture, history, and art. The shared vision between Explorer Maps and the Trail Less Traveled feels incredibly natural and full of great synergy. This exciting new collaborative partnership opportunity quickly evolved as we discovered the deep family roots we mutually share in both Africa and Montana. We invite you to travel the world with us as we bring cartography to life through storytelling, conservation, culture, history, and art. As members of 1% for the Planet, Explorer Maps donates a percentage of proceeds from every product sold to a variety of nonprofit organizations around the world. All of these organizations have similar missions as we do, focused on the conservation of wildlife and wild places. To date, Explorer Maps has donated more than $150,000 to more than 40 different organizations since they began in 2012. Through this unique relationship between Explorer Maps and the Trail Less Traveled, we will continue our commitment toward connecting people and place by raising awareness for the conservation of our public lands. You can get involved by supporting Explorer Maps, a small, family-owned business based in Missoula, Montana, with over 60 hand-drawn story maps. And be sure to use promo code MANDELA when visiting exploremaps.com. We're on location in Baja California Sur, sitting here on the Sea of Cortez with Gary Steele. Gary has been coming down to Baja for the past 30 years. He is a very experienced whitewater kayaker and sea kayaker. He has done descents all around the Northwest, around Montana, in whitewater kayaks. But more recently, he's keen on sea kayaking. And he's done a lot of sea kayaking as a guide on Yellowstone Lake, and also here in Baja with his friends and solo. And also, more recent, with his dog, Franklin. Gary, tell us about sea kayaking down in Baja.
One story that comes to mind, although I've had lots of trips down here and they've all been wonderful, one time we kind of pushed the barrier a little bit too much. This was during the Y2K. Everybody was concerned about the new millennium coming and if all the computers would crash and what was going to happen. And there was kind of fear running rampant in the United States. But my wife and myself and my friends Jesse King and Nathan Boot, both from Missoula, we decided we was going to come down to Baja for Y2K. So we came down before Christmas. We didn't really have no idea what we were getting into with the possible collapse of who knows what. But when we got here, I camped near the family that has been my friends for many, many years down here. We were talking with my friend Guadalupe, who is the matriarch of the family here. Her mother raised 11 kids in a cave down here. Guadalupe is about my age, and I ask her, I go, are you concerned about this Y2K stuff that's coming up? And she goes, oh, I am not concerned at all. I have my firewood and I have my goats. I need nothing else. So that was kind of a breath of fresh air in a little bit of a chaotic atmosphere. Shortly after Christmas, we left on a trip paddling south. We went around the big Punta Marcial. We went around a big point to the south, and we had really nice weather. Once we got around the point, there was some really nice little coves, and we hung out in the coves and fished and paddled with some dolphins. And then that first afternoon, I should say, the wind started coming up. It was a norte, is what they call it here, strong wind coming out from the north. The wind kept up, and it was a bad place to camp, so I told the rest of the crew, I go, just around this little point here, back the way we came a little bit, there's a really nice protected cove that would be a really nice place to weather the rest of this windstorm out. We loaded up our boats and got ready to go around this point. It was only like maybe a 5-minute paddle back to this other camp. But I told everybody that we could run into some extreme wind conditions along this short distance and that everybody should stick together. We took off, and as soon as we got around this point, the wind hit us with a vengeance, an offshore wind, and it was doing its hardest to blow us out to sea. And we had to paddle for every ounce of energy we had, way beyond what we thought we were capable of. I don't know how long we had to do this. It seemed like hours. My guess is it was maybe 30 minutes, something like that. And most of the time we were just sitting still in one spot. The wind would try to blow the bow of the kayak around. And if that would have happened, it would have been extremely difficult to get the kayak pointed back in the right position again. I was in a double kayak with my wife, Terry. Finally, we pulled in up to the beach. Terry, she jumped out of the front of the double kayak to pull the boat up onto the shore. As soon as her feet hit the sand, her back spasmed and went into a complete spasm mode, and she just fell down into the sand in complete agony. And we got the boat secure, and we helped Terry back up against this cliff where the wind wasn't blowing. And we stayed there for 3 days while the storm continued to blow. Finally, it was lessening a little bit, and we were also running out of water and food. So we decided it was time to try to get back around the big point to get back to where our car was parked. We went out, but as soon as we got around the point, things mellowed out, and then life got easier. And we chalked that up to experience, that sometimes paddling isn't just a bowl of cherries down here. Sometimes it's a paddle-or-die situation, and I've tried really hard since then to not put myself or my friends into that situation again.
We've been on location in Baja, California with Gary Steele. Thank you very much, Gary, for doing these interviews with me and for inviting me to come on these adventures with you.
This is the second year we've done this in a row. I hope it becomes a habit.
Me too. Thanks, Gary. Let's end this show with 3 outdoor adventure tips.
I guess the 3 things that I find important in my life is the importance of getting away from civilization. to be able to leave all technology behind just to get out in the wild. It refreshes the soul more than anything I can possibly imagine. And that, it helps with myself, with my inner self, I could say, helps me stay grounded with everything around me. One of the ways that I like to do this, at the end of the day, what I like to do is to have a happy hour. Just to take time to sit down, either with myself or with my friends, to sit in a beautiful place. I usually gravitate towards the edge of where the water meets the land. Whether that is a creek or a river in Montana, whether it's the shores of Yellowstone Lake, or whether it's the shore down here on the Sea of Cortez. But to sit down and to have a beer and to have a bowl and to sit with my friends and to just maybe not say nothing, just watch, just feel, just experience where we are. Those are important things in my life.
Gary, let's end the show with a song. What song would you like to end the show with?
I think a song that I think carries a lot of weight is Leonard Cohen's Everybody Knows. And my friend, guitar Steve, here on the beach, he sings this song very well. And I would like to ask Steve here if he would sing this song to wrap up this little interview.
Everybody Knows by Leonard Cohen. This is one of my favorite Leonard Cohen songs, and it was written back in the 80s, I believe. And it's still as relevant today as it was 30 years ago. I like it because it's typical Leonard Cohen. It can be very gloomy if you take what it's about, but it's also hilarious because some of the lines are just really funny about the fight being fixed and the dice loaded and everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. It's funny, but gloomy and true. The truth shall make you free. That the dice are loaded, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows that the war is over. Everybody knows that the good guy's lost. Everybody knows that the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows that the captain lied. Everybody's got that sinking feeling that their father or the dog just died. Everybody's looking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates. A long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful, give or take a night or two. Everybody knows that you were discreet. There were just so many people that you had to meet without your clothes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that it's now or never. Everybody knows that it's me or you. Everybody knows that you live forever. when you've done a line or two. Everybody knows that the deal was rotten. Old Black Joe, he's still picking cotton for your ribbon and bows. Everybody knows. Yeah, everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the plague is coming. Everybody knows that it's moving fast. Everybody knows that the naked man and woman are just shiny artifacts of the past. Everybody knows that the scene is dead. There's gonna be a meter on your bed that will disclose what everybody knows.
Namaste Missoula, Mandela here, your host of The Trail Less Traveled, the community source for adventure and conservation, information and inspiration. The show premieres every Sunday night at 6 Mountain Time, streaming live at trail1033.com. If you missed the premiere, you can find the Trail Less Traveled podcast everywhere podcasts are found. The Trail Less Traveled is a radio and podcast series dedicated to collecting stories and sounds from some of the most remote locations around the world in order to bring you, the listener, back to mankind's earliest form of entertainment, storytelling. We are incredibly excited to be collaborating with Explorer Maps, a small family business based in Missoula, Montana. Explorer Maps and the Trail Less Traveled are working together to bring cartography to life through storytelling, conservation, culture, history, and art. As members of 1% for the Planet, Explorer Maps donates a percentage of proceeds from every product sold to a variety of nonprofit organizations around the world. To date, Explorer Maps has donated more than $150,000 to more than 40 different organizations since they began in 2012. Through this unique relationship between Explorer Maps and the Trail Less Traveled, we will continue our commitment toward connecting people and place by raising awareness for conservation of wildlife and wild places. You can get involved by supporting Explorer Maps. They have over 60 hand-drawn story maps. They will be opening their world headquarters in Missoula, located on the corner of Inez and 3rd Street. And I hope to see you at the grand opening, because I'm currently in Africa and I'm working on a project with Game Rangers International in Zambia, and I will be providing a free multimedia adventure presentation at the new Explorer Map store on Saturday, November 18th at 7 p.m. If you've ever had a question for me regarding adventure, travel, or the past 20 years of recording The Trail Less Traveled, this would be a great opportunity to come and ask me a question in person. So set the date, Saturday, November 18th at 7 p.m. I will see you at the new Explorer Maps store. That's it for this week's adventure, my friends in Missoula and around the world. Until next week, please remember, conservation is not a spectator sport. Living in Missoula is a privilege, and with privilege comes responsibility. Please get informed and get engaged. Use your voice on behalf of wildlife and wild places. If you think you're too small to make a difference, you've never spent the night with a mosquito.